From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tim Klissel first visited China as an accountant in 1988 and fell hard for the China mystique. He quit his job, spent 2 years studying Mandarin in Beijing, and then crisscrossed the vast country with hundreds of millions of dollars burning in his pocket, hot for investment in China's economic coming-out party. It was a wild party. Tonight on Point, one man's enlightening journey through China on the brink of economic explosion. But first tonight, we turn to Washington, where the Supreme Court heard arguments today about whether displays of the Ten Commandments should be allowed on government property. The case could determine what happens to thousands of religious symbols on public property, including a frieze of Moses with the commandments in the Supreme Court itself. Dahlia Lithwick is Supreme Court reporter for Slate.com and joins me now. Dahlia, good to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing about this all day. Take us to the heart of it. As you listened in today, Dahlia, what is the heart of the consideration that's going on in the court?
Well, I think the heart of it is that the Supreme Court can't figure out what the heart of it is. What was very clear to me today is that the court is trying to answer a simple constitutional question. When has the state violated the principle that the government cannot establish religion?
Mm-hmm.
That's the First Amendment principle.
Right.
And the court has chummed up so many tests. I counted at least six that were referenced today for how to gauge that. And these tests are not only, you know, old and confusing, and parts of them have been discarded and parts resuscitated. They're also tests that are very narrow and very, very fact-specific. And so the court today evinced just not only confusion about how to talk about this, but confusion how to resolve it beyond the very, very narrow cases before it today.
Now, chummed up so many tests, that is absolutely wonderful Supreme Court reporter speak. But by that you mean they're saying, what should we hold these displays up to as the kind of litmus? How should we frame when this is acceptable and when it's not?
Precisely. There are some old tests that say, let's just look at the government's intent. Was the government's intent to foster religion? There's other tests that say, let's look at whether a reasonable observer would think the government was endorsing religion. There's other tests that say, would a minority or an atheist feel coerced looking at this into supporting religion? So there's this whole litany of different types of analysis. And because the court can't seem to sort of pick a horse and ride it, what we had today was the court literally picking test after test, throwing them at the attorneys, and trying to get the attorneys to then answer this incredible moving target. The core question seems to be, are these symbols religious or are they secular? And, of course, you get into this very, very weird position where the staunchest supporters of these monuments to the Ten Commandments are trying to immunize them by saying, oh, they're not religious.
They're secular.
They're historical, foundational documents that have nothing to do with religion.
Never Meanwhile, mind the burning bush. Never mind God handing them down to
never
Moses.
Never mind the folks on the front steps praying of the court who very much think these are religious symbols. In one very poignant moment, Justice Antonin Scalia, who is a very religious man himself, said that he was offended by the notion, by the argument, by the people who took his own side in support of these monuments who kept insisting they were secular. He said they're not secular. These are, in fact, a sign that we're a deeply religious country. And that is sort of the nut of the problem we have right now.
Dahlia, is there any chance that the court is going to come up with a sweeping decision that would even, you know, send the workmen up up in the ceiling of the court where they are today, where Moses is there with the tablets along with Hammurabi and Confucius and Napoleon? Is there a chance that they would deliver such a sweeping decision that all across the country, every little, you know, ingrained evidence of religious symbolism would have to come out of public buildings, or is it going to be much more nuanced than that?
I think there's absolutely no chance that they can hand down a ruling like that. I think far more likely is that they'll continue on the path that they've continued on, which sort of says, if it's a Tuesday and there's a reindeer next to Moses and, you know, it's raining, then it's constitutional. These very, very, very narrow... That's me being sarcastic, but, you know, these very, very narrow case-specific decisions. And so what we're going to get, my guess is, come June, is a decision about this one case that came out of Texas, mm-hmm. this other case that came out of Kentucky, and absolutely no insight into what to do with the Ten Commandment displays in Ohio.
And let me ask you this. How much is the court affected by the fact that the country itself is so kind of loaded with dynamite on this issue? I mean, they know what's going on out there. They've seen the blue and the red maps. They know there's a kind of big lines between secular America some days these days and religious America. How aware are they of that as they try and parse this?
I think they're extremely aware of that. And again, you know, I think that's what allowed someone like Justice Scalia to stand up and say, look, this is a religious country. And he made a funny little joke where he said 90% of Americans believe in the Ten Commandments, even though 85% of them couldn't tell you what they say.
Right.
So I think he's very aware, and the justices are very aware what an explosive issue this is and how polarizing it is. But they're also aware, I think at least some, that the court is supposed to sort of stand up for the minority and not let majorities necessarily have their way just because an idea is popular.
What kind of schedule are we on here? When might we have a decision?
Well, we know sometime between now and June. It's further complicated because Chief Justice Rehnquist is not hearing the arguments, mm-hmm. but he will be helping decide the case.
Dahlia Lithwick, always wonderful speaking with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dahlia Lithwick, Supreme Court reporter for Slate.com. She spoke with me from Washington. When Tim Klissold set out with hundreds of millions of dollars to invest in China, he could see no end to the country's potential. But to tap that potential, Klissold quickly learned, would mean operating outside any rule book. For rules in China didn't matter. Klissold responded as best he could when workers revolted, when millions disappeared, when the government turned its back and things got very strange. For a decade, Klissold wrestled his way, along with other foreign investors, into China's huge and opaque economy. He lost millions in the process, but he never lost his love for the country. Tonight on Point, one man's odyssey into the heart of China's economic explosion. You can join the conversation tonight. What's the most important thing to understand about the giant emerging in Asia? And what will be the new China's great mark on the world? After Confucius, after Mao, what drives China? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Tim Klissold, co-founder of the investment company Asimco that put $420 million into Chinese businesses in the late 90s. He is author of the new book, Mr. China, a Memoir. Tim Klissold, thanks for joining us tonight.
That was great.
It's good to have you. It's a wonderful book, a charming story with a lot of money right through it. What were you doing with $420 million?
Well, the idea was to really take a Western model of business and try to apply it to China. And we invested in a number of different factories within a specific industry, which was the automotive industry. And the idea was really to consolidate those businesses together and create a company that had a national market and a national presence and build it from there. But as you mentioned earlier, we found out very quickly that China doesn't really play by anybody else's rules.
Take us back. I mean, things have changed and continue to change so quickly in China that even though you're writing here about sort of the period from the mid-90s to 2002 or so, we already feel in something of a new chapter. What was the chapter in China's economic development that you were walking into with this bundle of cash?
It was really the first sort of opening up of China, where I think that actually the Chinese were trying to find their way through the maze as well, as much as foreigners were. Because you have to remember that China is actually quite a young state, and it was only founded 55 years ago.
Modern China. I mean, it's
that modern China. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, the present state. Yeah, the People's Republic. And you know, after it was founded, there were a series of sort of policy-induced disasters. So China's really only got its act together in the last 25 years. So it was really from the early to the late 90s, it was really sort of China coming out into the world and also trying to figure out how to deal with, you know, foreigners' money that was coming in.
And the money that you brought was what? Money from very, very large investors and institutions who saw the famous, the ever at desirable billion China market, billion person China market opening up. They wanted to be in on it?
That's right. And yes, there were big institutional investors in mostly in the United States. And, you know, frankly, I think we all sort of became a little over enamored with the headline. And, you know, the headline is 1.3 billion customers. And, you know, then the sort of subheadings are, you know, direct investment into China is running at, you know, billions a year. And you've got a very enormous pool of low-cost manufacturing talent. And, you know, at the headline level, China just looks so sort of irresistible and attractive that, you know, in retrospect, I think that people would say that people developed sort of an excessive optimism about it. And probably do things in China that you wouldn't really do in any other country.
Mm-hmm. So there you were, eating steamed rabbit ears, drinking gallons of fire water, and really scouring the back roads of China for factories that you could pour this money into. We want to hear a lot about that. But when you look between the time you were investing this money and today, Tim, has China already moved into a new phase or not?
I think it has. I think that China's made tremendous progress in the last 5 years. And I would say that that's been stimulated by China's accession to WTO, which actually I think was a very courageous decision on behalf of the Chinese leadership, because it's really opened up some of the real structural industries in China to enormous challenges. And, you know, frankly, it's difficult to see how some of, you know, China's industries can really compete without those barriers there.
Tim Clissold is author of the new book, Mr. China, a memoir. We're talking tonight about his Chinese odyssey, his journey into the heart of China's economic explosion. You can join the conversation. What is most important to understand about the old, new giant emerging in East Asia? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about one man's Chinese odyssey, his journey into the heart of China's economic explosion. My guest is Tim Clissold. He joins us from New York. He's author of Mr. China, a memoir. It's a story of him with a partner setting out in the mid-90s to invest more than $400 million in a very rough Chinese economy. A lot of cycles of evolution since then, but quite a tale as they invested and lost much of that money in the economic backroads of China. Tim Clissold, I'm struck in the wonderful stories you tell here by how profit is a big motivator, but when it comes to China, as you write, there's always the issue of the romance of China that comes in. I wish you'd be good enough to read from the first page of your book to help explain to us your title, Mr. China, how that kind of allure of becoming the great China expert, the China hand, comes in.
Yeah, I think there is a great allure about China, which sort of makes people, as I said earlier, sort of over-optimistic. But I sort of start the book with this idea of the guy who really wants to be Mr. China, and he wants to be the first guy that cracks the market. And I wrote, the idea of China has always exerted a pull on the adventurous type. There's a kind of entrepreneurial Westerner who just can't resist it. You've got red flags, a billion bicycles, and the largest untapped market on earth. What more could you want? And after the first few visits, they start to feel more in tune and experience the first stirrings of a really fatal ambition, the secret hope of becoming the Mr. China of their time, or the Zhongguo Tong, or the old China hand with the inside track in the Middle Kingdom. In the end, they all want to be Mr. China. They want to be like Marco Polo, roaming China as the emissary of the Kublai Khan, or the first pioneering mill owners lolling about in the opium dens in Shanghai, dreaming of the fortune to be made if every Chinese would add an inch to his shirt tails. Kissinger must have felt like Mr. China as he schemed against Russia with Zhou Enlai. Edgar Snow may have been the same as he stood on the gateway of heavenly peace with Chairman Mao. Mm. And of the countless businessmen who come to China with high hopes of the billion-three market, how many long to become the ultimate China hand, the only outsider, the first and only Lao Wai to crack China? But in the end, it's all an illusion.
An illusion, but no doubt yours. Tim Clissold, reading there from his book, Mr. China, you were clearly infected with that same kind of allure.
I was very much so. I mean, one of the problems about China is it grows terribly in fits and starts. So you can arrive in China, say, in 1992, and everything looks absolutely fantastic and all the numbers are going through the roof. and then suddenly the brakes are applied by the, you know, the government, and it sort of goes straight into reverse. So if you then sort of fast forward to 96 and 97, you know, the economy everywhere is having a really tough time. And then, of course, we're on an upward slide again. So, you know, at the moment, China's sort of, again, in boom time. So there's still a huge amount of money coming into China at the moment. There's about $1 billion a week coming into China in foreign direct investments at the moment.
That's a lot of optimism. We want to strap in with you and sort of get in the time machine and go back, if you'd be good enough, to take us back to when you were making your first forays into China with your partner, who you describe as, who you call Pat. You say everything's true in this book, but some of the names are changed. Take us into those first forays you made, looking for where to invest that money. What did you see? How did you travel? Where did you go? What do the factories look like? What do the opportunities look like?
We traveled really all over China. I mean, we went right from, you know, the frozen oil fields up in the northeast near the Russian border, in a place called Chichihar, right down to the foothills of Tibet in southwestern China, in Sichuan, and visited more than 100 factories in the space of about 6 months. So, you know, we really did our homework. And a lot of these factories really weren't like factories at all in a Western context. You know, I remember going to one which had an area of 5 square miles, and it was surrounded by these enormous great walls with a big sort of gate at the front. And it had a population of 30,000 people.
Inside
and
the factory walls.
Inside, yeah, inside, the, you know, the hospitals.
Yeah.
And kindergartens and cinemas.
This is because this was a state-run factory, presumably.
That, yes, it was very much a state-run factory. But it was almost as if the guy who was running the factory wasn't really a CEO. He was more like a mayor. And that was a really important thing to understand, because there are all sorts of other functions that are attached to businesses, you know, like welfare of huge numbers of people. Which, of course, you know, you just don't have in a Western context.
You write about three characters in particular, or around three investments that kind of frame a variety of the characters that you found there. There's Madame Wu, Chen Haiqing, and Old Shi, as you describe them, a real sort of showman, risk-taker, a guy stuck in the middle between China's entrepreneurial culture and its old state-oriented culture, and then Madame Wu, the kind of changeless China. We should give us, in a nutshell, these stories. As you invested in, as you say, automotive and breweries, yeah, beer breweries, take us into the stories of these three.
Well, the first story that I chose was where we invested quite a lot of money, about $20 million, in a factory which had been built by an individual, and it was right up in the mountains in the central province of Anhui, and it's a really, really beautiful place. You know, fantastic natural beauty. It's set in these enormous bamboo forests, and it's in a little valley with, you know, streams and stone bridges.
This
really
is a traditionally poor province, and also unusual in that an individual had built this.
That's right. So it was completely outside the state system. So this guy, Old Shi, was totally unbound by any sort of regulation or rules. And we invested these dollars in his factory, and discovered about 2 years later that he'd used quite a large proportion of it to set up another factory just down the road, which was competing with us. So, you know, we were sort of stuck in this very remote rural area, you know, with this guy churning out the same type of products as we were.
What was he making in the factories?
It's a kind of a technical product. It's part of a shock absorber system in a car.
Mm-hmm.
We had the most incredible battle to remove him, which actually culminated in sort of, you know, quite serious civil unrest with street battles, which were only brought under control when the prefectural party secretary called in the army.
Street battles,
so
because
he rallied
the workers against
that's
you
right.
when you tried to move him out.
That's right. And, you know, we had strikes, the electricity was cut off, not just to the factory, to the entire town.
Now, this was the time when the thing to do was joint ventures, and you did 19 of them.
Yes.
And as I recall, you found that in 17 of those 19, you had to change the management of the establishment, of the factory.
That's right. And it involved, the most protracted battles, which is, you know, the main sort of core story of the book, was essentially going into China with a very, very large amount of money, with sort of preconceived notions of how business should be done, finding out that that really wasn't the way that Chinese businessmen ran their business in the state-run system, you know, a struggle to try and persuade them to change, realizing that wouldn't work, and then taking this really dramatic action of booting them out of the factories.
And it was a struggle every time. But in this first story, in Old Xue's story, you find one type that you say is very much abroad in China, the risk taker, completely unbound by convention or regulation, an irrepressible showman. Do you see that type at work throughout the Chinese economy today?
Yeah, and they're actually very attractive people in a lot of ways, because they will never take no for an answer, and they're completely undeflectable. And determined to, you know, make a success of whatever they're doing. That I think is a very attractive characteristic. And I think it sort of comes from the fact that there's been so much turmoil in China, particularly for people who are, say, you know, in their 50s. Their sort of younger years were just so full of turmoil and changes and
cultural revolution, all the rest.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. That they have the most incredible nerve.
I've had friends say,
I just find that quite attractive, actually.
I've had friends say that the Mao years sort of swept away the Confucian legacy.
It tried to. I mean, that was the purpose of it. The Cultural Revolution was meant to smash China's culture.
And then, of course, the backlash against that smashed a lot of Maoism. I mean, both still working there. But I've heard many Chinese say that the sort of moral structure of the country has really been chopped down at many levels. It is kind of a free zone in some ways.
Well, it is. And I mean, there are lots of writers who, Chinese writers who comment sort of on the fact that China sort of absorbed foreign ideas and it's turning into a very sort of short-term consumerist society. But I think that the traditional thought in China is very, very robust. China survived repeated invasions at every sort of 300 years over its long history. And, you know, even Mao attempted to smash the old culture, and he sort of found out that it was sort of unsmashable, if you like. It's a very, very robust set of ideas.
But a lot of contradictions, as Mao might say. The story of Chen Haijing, give us this one. You describe him as the Chinese archetype these days, stuck in some middle ground, halfway between official and entrepreneur, sort of balancing maybe incompatible elements between China's economic and political systems.
That's right. He was a completely different character from Old Xue, who was the real sort of entrepreneur. He was more sort of more bureaucratic style. And the core problem in his business was that despite the fact it had, you know, very healthy revenues, it never made money.
What was his business?
And we could never sort of figure that out.
What was he doing? What was his business?
He made starter motors and alternators for automotive. Mm-hmm. And he was determined to access other sources of capital to really start his own business in the way that Xue had done. Mm. And he wanted to go public, and he couldn't go public because he didn't have enough assets underneath the Chinese rules. So what eventually transpired is that he illegally conveyed a large and very valuable piece of land out of our joint venture and back to himself using a series of sort of fairly complex transactions.
It sounds like a WorldCom scale in Chinese terms, a little
yeah,
sleight of hand there.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very Chinese way of doing it, because in China, transactions are actually proved by chops, which are these little sort of round seals that you dip in red ink.
Right, like a signature.
It's like a signature, but it's very different from a signature because with a signature, you can tell who actually signed it with a chop. You don't know who actually chopped the piece of paper.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So, we got into the most extraordinary battle to oust him and get our land back.
Give us a moment that might show us just how extraordinary. Where did it really get strange?
There was one instance where I was surrounded by 60 workers in a room for 9 hours with the police outside trying to get me out. And another instance where we were sitting in an upstairs office and a full bottle of beer smashed through the window and exploded on the wall next to our heads. So it did really get fairly intense.
Why were the 60 workers surrounding you there? What did they want from you?
Because it was the most extraordinary sort of bizarre occurrence, because what happened was we removed the general manager from the business after mm-hmm. we found that he conveyed this land out. Mm. And then he feigned illness, and he was slapped into intensive care in a local hospital.
But actually, he was operating the business from his hospital
bed. That's right. And it was really to whip up the emotion in the factory to, you know, try and sort of intimidate us to back down. And that's really what happened. So the purpose of me being surrounded was trying to get me to sign a piece of paper to reappoint him.
There are more stories you want to hear. We're talking with Tim Klissel. He's author of Mr. China, a memoir. But there are callers who want to join us. I want to invite them in. Chris is calling from Boston, Massachusetts, of course. Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I'd like to ask a question. I am an entrepreneur who was working in the automotive industry for some time, trying to develop a product for the industry. And for years, I tried to find partners and investors for this project. So my question to you and your guest is, and let me add to that, this was a very, very frustrating experience, and I couldn't even get $250,000 to do anything while people were investing in dot-coms.
We can hear it in your voice, Chris. So your question for Tim Klissel?
Is really, why would investors wish to go to the other side of the world and invest in high-risk ventures, and in this case, not even financial risk, but physical risk, mm-hmm. When they can have people at MIT and Harvard Laboratories who want to develop products for the automotive industry, a growing industry around the world, including China, and the rest of the world, and we can't get any money at all for these projects, and yet you guys want to go to China face virtual revolution.
We've got it. There it is, Chris. And we hear the frustration in your voice. And Tim Klissel, there's kind of the great American question. Why were you? Why does money pour into China when right here in the States or in your home country, in the UK, plenty of folks with great ideas and entrepreneurs who want to get things started? Why?
I think that investors look at China and they say, China is now at the same stage of development as the United States was in the late 1800s. And they sort of look at a very, very big picture level. And they say that if we get in on the ground floor, there is the chance to create a company which could have, you know, a serious global presence. So there's now the chance to create something like J.P. Morgan created in the States, 150 years ago. There's the chance to do that in China.
The new General Motors, but based in China.
That's right.
This time.
That's right.
What does that mean?
Of course, the devil's in the detail.
Of course. We see how difficult it is, and you can fall on your face, and who knows what will happen. But what do you think that means long-term for innovators in outside of China, like Chris, who are saying, hey, look at me?
Well, I mean, I think that actually there's not really a shortage of capital in, you know, the Western financial system. I can't really see that China's going to sort of guzzle up so much capital from, you know, the Western economies that we can't continue to finance ventures in the States and Europe.
So you don't see it as an either or, and yet of course the fascination.
It's not really
China's
an either or. Yeah, I don't think it's an either or. I mean, I think if you have a good project, I mean, the real core issue actually is to speak the investor's language. And that's not something, you know, I admit it's not actually something that I do particularly well. Most of the capital is raised by, you know, my Wall Street friend. Mm-hmm. If you've got the knack of raising money, you know, the power of the Wall Street money machine is quite mind boggling. You can go to a 2-hour meeting and if you can talk the talk, you can raise $15 million. As I say, in a 2-hour meeting.
I've seen
people
it.
Who've never even visited the country.
So talk the talk and good luck. But yet and still, there's that lure, that allure of China right across the sea. Chris, thanks for your call. Tim Klissel, you right in the front of the book, you have a quotation from Chairman Mao. Everything under heaven is in utter chaos. The situation is excellent. Does that describe your experience of China?
It does. I love that quote because, of course, according to Western concept, the idea of everything being in utter chaos and the situation being great doesn't make any sense. But it kind of does describe China incredibly well, I think, because it is a very chaotic country. It is very difficult to govern from the center. You know, even the Chinese government has enormous problems in imposing its own regulations. So it is in a situation of complete chaos, but somehow it sort of muddles through. And, you know, the trends are fantastically good and have been for, really the last sort of decade.
Tim Clissold, stand by. I want to get to more of our callers. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about one man's Chinese odyssey, his journey into the heart of China's economic explosion. Tim Clissold is with me. His book is Mr. China, a memoir. You can join us. Have you taken a business to China or invested there? How did it go? And are the twain finally meeting? Or is East always East and West always West, even after China's boom? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking tonight about one man's Chinese odyssey, a journey into the heart of China's economic explosion. My guest is Tim Clissold. He's author of Mr. China, a memoir. He was there investing hundreds of millions in the 90s when things were really beginning to pull together in China economically, but not in any kind of way that most Western businessmen would recognize. He had some wild times on those back roads, lost a lot of that money, and yet it continues to go in. As he says, many Western businessmen see China today as tantamount or equivalent to the United States in the late 19th century. Imagine it, all the growth that was ahead of the USA then. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. What should we take away from these stories about China? What's most important for us to understand about this emerging economic giant? 1-800-423-TALK. Roland is calling from New York City. Hi, Roland. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I haven't read your book yet, but I will. I found it fascinating.
Thank you.
I've done some work in China, and essentially I wanted to know, let me just before I ask my question, there's an old Chinese proverb that the emperor, the walls are high, the emperor's far away.
Right.
And I think that starting from the first emperor onto the People's Revolution, China wasn't really one country. The emperor could send a tax collector from Beijing to Ningxia, and he would have his head sent back. The difficulty with doing business in China, and I want to know whether you agree with me, is that to some degree you don't know who you're dealing with. But if you do your due diligence and are careful, and this is all being helped by the WTO ascension, you can be greatly helped. But how well informed were your investors? I'm assuming this money wasn't yours personally, right?
Of course not.
$400 million, no.
How well informed are your investors as to who they were dealing with? Because I've had clients who have negotiated deals with people in one province to find out that someone in Beijing had to approve it. And if that didn't happen, the whole thing fell apart.
Mm-hmm. Tim Clissold, what do you say? The sort of layers, the difficulty of due diligence when there's so much that's opaque and obscure. I guess your investors knew what you told them. You were the guy in the field. So how well informed or ignorant did you turn out to be?
I mean, I think the proverb that you just referred to, which is the hills are high and the emperor is far away. Mm. What that really means is that if you're in a remote province in China, you don't really have to listen to what the center is saying, and that really still does apply. And that's something that's tremendously important to understand about China. You know, people think that it's this big sort of heavy communist state that's sort of weighing down on the necks of ordinary people in China. It's not like that. It's much, much more chaotic. It's much, much more difficult to govern. And there are areas in China where the writ of the central government not quite doesn't run, but local officials will bend rules, or they'll change them. They'll sort of manipulate them to suit their own local purposes. And that is something that's very, very important to understand about China. It wasn't obvious to us until we'd actually done business in China that was really the case.
But can you, even now, when the World Trade Organization rules have been pulled into China, at least formally, can you do anything like the due diligence there that would be expected in Europe or in the United States? Can you really figure out who's pulling the strings? How much transparency is there today?
Right, I think you can do that. And I would say that actually our problems were not related to due diligence. We never invested in a business and then suddenly found out some awful thing about the business, or maybe there's another competitor in Shanghai or something that we didn't know about. So I really do think you can do due diligence. The problem is much more in the ongoing management, and that's where we tripped up, because Chinese business is just incredibly complex to run and manage. And that's where you get sort of completely enmeshed in government relationships, which are, you know, very difficult to deal with.
And why so much more complex? Because of government involvement or something else?
It's because of government involvement, and it's because the rules aren't clear. So, you know, quite often Chinese law is actually written in quite a vague way. So even if you actually go back to the statute, it's kind of not completely clear what it means. And you'll find sort of inconsistencies between laws. You might even find contradictions between certain regulations. So and then, of course, there's the interpretation of it, which actually allows for quite a lot of leeway for discretion at the local level. So it's kind of just figuring out what the ground rules are. It can sometimes be very, very tough.
Gregory's calling from Upper Saddle River, New Jersey. Hi, Gregory. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Fascinating conversation. I got two questions. One of them is, what is it about the character? It's like this fellow, what was his name, Old Shure?
Old Shure, yeah.
And this happened more than once. How do they rationalize it to themselves? I mean, they can't all be consistently evil people. So what are they saying? What's the argument they say to themselves? Like, right. I'm going to create a factory and compete against my benefactor.
Right, okay.
Is that a Chinese perception?
Tim Clissold.
Right, okay. The only problem with me answering that question is I have to get into quite a lot of detail about exactly what happened and what the background was. But in a nutshell, what happened was that Old Shure felt that we had not delivered on a promise that we'd made, and we hadn't sort of got the right technology into the plant, and we hadn't provided him with the opportunity to raise more money through a public offering. And I think that that's how he justified doing what he did. And of course, you know, when you actually got into all the detail about whether he's really competing and what kind of technology he was using, it all got sort of, you know, the devil was in the detail again. So I was actually able to rationalize what he'd done to a degree that didn't break the relationship that I had with him. I still actually in touch with him. I went and saw him about 3 weeks ago, just before Chinese New Year. And he's still exactly the same guy, and he's still totally irrepressible, and he's running a very successful business down in the valley. And I think it's because I could kind of understand where he was coming from, that he had built this business up from absolutely nothing through years and years of struggle. And then he'd gone into a partnership with a foreign investor who really didn't kind of live up to exactly what he wanted. That I could, you know, he'd done something that was bad and he shouldn't have done it, and he was punished for it. But, you know, I was able to kind of feel some forgiveness for it, really, I suppose, if you like.
So you describe him as a type, this type unbound by convention or regulation, but you're also describing some kind of, internal value system that you recognize with him, that it's not values-free.
The Chinese are extremely rational, and they follow their own interests in a way in some sense is even more predictable than in Europe or the States. So they do completely follow their own economic benefit. And if you can find a framework where you're contributing towards that on an ongoing basis, then you can have a partner that you could, you know, trust incredibly well. If there's a continuing basis to the partnership, you're safe. If the partnership is just purely based on a one-off event, like investing money right up front, and then all you've got to rely on is a contract, then you're in trouble. And that's kind of the way that Chinese businessmen look at business relationships, as an ongoing sort of developing thing. And, you know, I sometimes describe the way they look at a contract as being like a snapshot of a set of arrangements that exist at a particular time. And of course, that's very repugnant in a Western context. But if you can kind of really understand that and reach over and understand what the true basis, ongoing basis of the relationship is, then I actually think it works quite well.
You better have a deep sort of organic logic to the relationship.
Correct.
And then it can go. You also describe, and Gregory, thanks for your call, by the way, as I look at the numbers here that are coming out more lately, the whole idea of doing joint ventures seems to have been very popular in the period you were investing, but not very popular now. So many Western companies just building their own factories in China, not as joint ventures.
That's absolutely right. And what happened was there was a big peak in foreign direct investment around 92, 93. And then there was a cutback, as people realized that joint ventures were problematic. And the governments have relaxed regulations and so on. And those two factors pushed the balance of foreign direct investment into wholly owned subsidiaries, so that in 1999, that was the first year where more direct investment came in the form of wholly owned subsidiaries rather than joint ventures. But there's actually something inherently difficult about joint ventures. I mean, a joint venture between, you know, a UK firm and a German firm, or, you know, Daimler Chrysler, I mean, a US firm and a German firm, is, you know, it's problematic anyway. And then you sort of layer in all these other sort of cultural differences and language blocks and so on. You know, they're just difficult to manage.
And so we've got big, huge new investments from GM, Toyota, Volkswagen, Anheuser-Busch. I mean, those both the fields that you know well, putting in big bucks to build their own facilities for that market and for export, I guess.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, in a way, actually, I mean, I think Anheuser-Busch is, you know, a fantastic company. I think ultimately it will be successful in China. But that case is actually really interesting because last year they paid $750 million for a brewery up in
Harbin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, you know, it's not particularly Yeah, in the northeast of China, it's a very, very cold climate. Mm-hmm. I was up there about 3 weeks ago. It was minus 20 degrees centigrade. You know, it's not a particularly wealthy area of China. It's not a particularly core strategic market. And, you know, it's a medium-sized brewery. And
so why are they there?
As I say, well, I mean, you know, they paid a PE of 50 for that business, which is, a, you know, a dot-com price.
This so is the ratio of profit
profits
to what
they're putting in. Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, a huge dot-com price. Mm-hmm. And I think that just illustrates this thing. There's just something about China. There's something about China that makes businessmen do things that they wouldn't do anywhere else.
Jason's calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Yes, I've been taking Chinese for 2 years at my middle school, and I was wondering what type of industries are mostly popping up in China.
In other words, you're thinking about a future career, Jason?
Yes, sir.
And where you might best plug in as a Chinese-speaking American?
Yes, sir.
Let's look at that. Tim Klissel?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think it's fantastic that you're learning Mandarin because, you know, not only will it really help you, you know, in being successful in business and really sort of understanding what's going on. But I think you'll get, you know, a huge amount of pleasure out of it as well. In terms of, you know, industries to look at, you know, I think anything to do with manufacturing is going to be very, very competitive in China for, you know, probably the next 30 years.
And what's the role for a young American there?
Well, I mean, I think that there are all sorts of, you know, areas where, you know, in terms of bringing in, you know, hard and soft skills from a Western environment and applying it in a Chinese context where, you know, you have an advantage as a Westerner because you understand, you know, the Western context better.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in China, you can speak Mandarin, then maybe that will sort of help you, you know, choose the parts of that which can be sort of most successfully transplanted into China.
So anything that intersects with manufacturing, we've sort of seen the evidence of that. What else?
I think financial services also because that's an area where China's got an enormous amount of catch-up. So, you know, if you're involved in anything like, you know, in the investment business or commercial banking, insurance, anything like that, then I think that there's going to be a tremendous need for skills in those areas also moving forward.
Jason, there's a big bravo to you for studying Chinese and good luck with it. Joe is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes. I had 72 round trips across the Himalayas in 1945. That's we flew out of Burma, and that's the only way that China got anything. We had it taken in by air.
The famous Burma airlift there, yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
72 trips, and you did it, and you survived. We're glad to be talking with you, Joe.
Well, it was awful this time of year. The main fear was Kunming, and one of my sons and I went back there for a trip 5 years ago. And the Kunming was a little dirty field, cold as a son of a gun this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And you had built a city there of 3.5 million people. But one of the sites we went to, they manufactured steel and used soft coal. And the smog was so thick you couldn't see the sun. And we had a very articulate interpreter, a very nice young man. And I said to him, oh, why did you move here? He said, when my wife and I got out of college, we were told to move here.
Yeah.
And I asked him about his family, and he said, we have one son, and if we have another son, we'll get a huge fine, and we'll both get fired. So I think they're still pretty well controlled, even though there's a great deal. We went to cities that you'd never heard of with millions and millions of people. But I from that experience, I would say that they're pretty well controlled still.
Joe, we've got it, and thanks for sharing that comparison from all those years ago in World War II to just 5 years ago. Tim Clissold, you had a similar experience in a way when this was all over. You decided you'd seen a lot of factories but needed to get closer to China. You flew out to Xi'an in central China, bought a bicycle, and rode it back to Beijing. That is many hundreds of miles. And you saw some beautiful countryside, wonderful people, but also some pretty harrowing evidence of what's going on in China.
That's right. I mean, I think the last caller's pinpointed one of the core issues in China, actually. And that is that China's involved in this tremendous catch-up with Western economies. They haven't paid enough attention to pollution control because it costs.
Sure.
There are some areas which are just quite mind-boggling. I mean, I went through on this bicycle ride that I did through a coal mining area, and I was really, really shocked by what I saw, and everything was black. I mean, the trees were black, the ground was black, the air was black, the people's faces were black, their clothes, everything. There was this oily coal dust absolutely everywhere, and it was, it was just like a sort of lunar landscape, really. So I think that, that is a really, really serious issue in China.
So,
which is going to cost billions to correct.
Right. And you note that so much of China is paying the environmental cost and so many Chinese are living in the midst of it. After all this experience, Tim, how do you see things? Do you see China as placed as the United States was placed in the late 19th century? Do you see it as that great, that enormous an opportunity economically?
I mean, I am fundamentally extremely optimistic about China, because I think that the central leadership in China, they're struggling with mind-boggling problems, but they're a small group of very, very smart people. And I do think that they are open to persuasion. I sometimes don't think we give them enough credit for really sort of listening to the types of criticisms that are justifiably sort of raised against them. Mm. And, just one of a quick observation. I remember being quite sort of surprised listening to the mayor of Shenzhen, which is a big booming city
down by Hong Kong,
just nearby Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And the mayor of Shenzhen was talking about Locke's theory of the three separations of government, where in Western democracies, mm-hmm. you've got the legislature, executive, and judiciary separated. And, the idea of, say, Tony Blair in the UK sort of standing up in the House of Commons and talking about Taoism,
very
just
unlikely.
Really isn't on the cards.
Tim Clissold, it's been an amazing ride you've taken us on, that you took yourself on, and we appreciate your sharing it with us in the book and on the air tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tim Clissold's last words in the book: if by writing this book I can make the Chinese people seem more human, less mysterious or threatening, just flawed and beautiful like us, then the troubles of the past 10 years will all have been worthwhile. What a future coming on. Tim Clissold's book is Mr. China, a Memoir. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for On Point comes from